Good evening. Well, here we are, 3 days before the winter solstice. So many activities going on in the world. And here we are, together. I want to talk this evening about something that happens often, I think, in Zen, maybe in other religions and practices too, but I'm going to talk about Zen tonight. Why not? That is that sometimes, maybe at the beginning of practice, you know, you might know why you come to practice, or you might not, but one way or another, here you are. Some of you have been coming here for a long time. Some maybe not so long. But something touches us, or we wouldn't come back. I mean, you don't have to do this. You don't have to do this. So, often, one of the things that touches us is that we hear something. Maybe we feel something too. Like I know for me, the very, very, very first thing that took me into the Zendo, this was in Tassajara, a mountain monastery. I was there as a guest, and I heard the bells. I heard these bells, and then I saw these quiet people shuffling at dawn up to this building that had candle, looked like it had candlelight coming out of it, and I thought, what's going on up there? I think I'll go see where they're going. So I went in and found my way to a cushion, and then I heard that big bronze bell. Now, that's our bronze bell there, that one there between Martha and Patrick. The one at Tassajara is this big. It's about that tall. I mean, I don't know. Am I exaggerating? Sometimes, no, okay, Rachel knows. And I mean, when you hit that thing, you know, it's like, boom, and you feel it in your body. Your whole being, you know, it feels this bell. So, honestly, that was the first thing that struck me about Zen. I had read some things, you know, I was a hippie, and so we were all, a lot of us were reading Zen. It was cool. I had a high school teacher who was into Zen, and he had some copies of The Wind Bell, early copies of The Wind Bell, Suzuki Roshi, his first book. So I was aware of Zen, but that bell, that was the thing that some part of me went, ah, didn't know what it was. So sometimes it's like that. Sometimes it's a feeling. Sometimes it's a smell or a something. But often it's some words that you hear. You hear a part of a chant, or you hear a part of a teaching. And again, some part of you, just like with that big bell, some part of you goes, oh, and you want to go closer to that. You want to know more about it. Maybe you want to know, what does that mean? Or, ooh, maybe if I go there, I'll hear it again. So I don't know if there's an official name in Zen for that. I know that if you hear words at a particular time that allows you to have an insight, that's often referred to as turning words. Someone will offer you some turning words. And maybe that's happened to you sometime in your life. It could be something from Zen, or it could just be in your life. You know, one of those things that happens. Somebody says something to you, and you just wake up. You just wake up. You just go, oh. So that would be like a turning word. The words that first attract us and draw us in, I don't know if there's an official name for that, but I want to talk about some of those. And then there's also, I think, those same things that can happen to us maybe a little bit later in practice when we've been studying and we've been developing a little bit of understanding about the teachings, kind of a landscape of whatever type of Zen or which ancestors we like. I'll talk about the landscape I tend to hang out in. And maybe then a little further on the line, you'll come upon a teaching that then becomes something that has you go deeper in your practice. So, of course, it's one of those delightful paradoxes of Zen where, on the one hand, it's just this. On the other hand, there's all these books for centuries. So it's kind of sweet, I think, that even though this practice is really just present moment awareness, nonetheless, there's stories and teachings. How sweet is that? So I want to share about a couple of them, and I actually, you might start thinking, because I think it would be fun, and I'll ask you at some point, if you had such a thing, if there was a line that first drew you in, I'd love to hear a few of them, or a couple of lines, just for fun, just to hear some of the diversity of what this is for us. So the very, very first thing that I remember, of course, there was Catherine saying, just sit and follow your breath. But fairly soon, she started to introduce us to Ehe Dogen, and this was, at that time, kind of the only book. This was the first Moon in a Dewdrop that came out in 1985. And I remember, Zen student, my teacher's talking about Dogen, I'm going to get this book. You know, I cracked it open, I started reading it. I mean, some of it was pretty out there. But right away, in the very, very beginning, like the very first, let's see, what is it here? Oh, how cute, I even wrote my name in the book. Remember when you used to write your name in your books? Kathy Toldy. You know, I wrote this is my book. This is my Zen book. So, in fact, this is a total sidebar, but it's funny. Also, early on in my Zen teaching, I bought these books called the Blue Cliff Record. I bought the paper set, and I remember I tried and tried and tried, could not understand a word of it. And I tried and tried and tried. I'd written my name in it. Kathy Toldy. So I finally took them to Logos. It's like, forget about it. And years later, Jaku said she bought those books and my name was in it. This was way back when. She said, Kathy, I just bought your books somewhere like in San Francisco or something. They had made their way through the used books collections of Zen. So anyhow, here it was right in the very beginning of Moon in a Dewdrop, Guidelines for Studying the Way. I thought, that sounds pretty straightforward. Maybe I'll start with that. Gakudo Yojin Shu. So at this time, Jean was involved in rock climbing, and he was with a friend. They went down to Joshua Tree to climb rocks, and I went down with them, and I brought my Dogen. So I had the whole day. They were off climbing rocks, and I sat myself down with my Dogen. And before me was just this expanse of rocky desert landscape, which, as you know, I have come to love so well. And I was reading and reading, and then I read this. It's two paragraphs, and it's right in part three of Guidelines for Studying the Way. The title of this section is, In the Buddha Way, You Should Always Enter Enlightenment Through Practice. You should know that arousing practice in the midst of delusion, you attain realization before you recognize it. At this time, you first know that the raft of discourse is like yesterday's dream, and you finally cut off your old understanding bound up in the vines and serpents of words. This is not made to happen by Buddha, but is accomplished by your all-encompassing effort. Moreover, what practice calls forth is enlightenment. Your treasure house does not come from outside. How enlightenment functions is through practice. How could actions of mind ground go astray? So if you turn the eye of enlightenment and reflect back on the realm of practice, nothing in particular hits the eye, and you just see white clouds for 10,000 miles. And I looked up and I saw white clouds for 10,000 miles. It was right there. It was right here. And my body, it was just like with that bell, my body went, oh. And then, of course, I went back, and over, I studied this paragraph. And those of you who know me, you've heard me talk about this before. This, you should know that arousing practice in the midst of delusion, you attain realization before you recognize it. Just that line. Just that line. All the ways that we think we have to be enlightened and we're messing up and we're not good enough and we're never going to be good enough and we're so deluded. Arousing your practice in the midst of this very delusion is enlightenment. It, the act of arousing practice, the act of noticing, the act of attending to our mind, to the moment, you attain realization before you recognize it. At this time, you first know that the raft of discourse is like yesterday's dream. The raft of discourse. Yesterday's dream. And because you are arousing your practice right now, you're cutting off your old understanding, bound up in the vines and serpents of words. And guess what? This is not made to happen by Buddha. It happens by your all-encompassing effort. What practice calls forth is enlightenment. Your treasure house does not come from outside. So that for me, that carried me for years. Just that, practicing that, studying that, investigating that. Of course, there were a lot of other wonderful things to read and to study and to learn about, but I would say, you know, the combination of that body world experience of actually seeing and feeling the vastness of awakening, and then having this incredibly generous teaching about how to work with our humanity and our delusion just was, for me, one of those things that just made me very interested in walking this path and finding out more. I wonder what else he has to say. What is this? What is this teaching? This is something interesting to me. So before I go forward and talk about one that has for me come more recently, I'd say maybe in the last 10 years, as one of these deepening phrases, I would just love to invite a few of you, if you know what yours is, just very succinctly, just say what is the line that you can remember, or a line that really first touched you and had you be interested in the Buddha way. Jean? Thank you. Is there anyone else? Yeah, Rachel?
Watching. your mind.
When do you remember first hearing that?
Before I even encountered Zen, which was a revelation of its own, my first meditation instructor said, watch your mind.
One could practice with that one's entire life. What is that? Thank you. Scott?
When your practice is calm and ordinary everyday life, it's enlightening.
Suzuki Roshi. Thank you. Yeah.
The bells particularly intrigued me, and the everyone rushing to the zendo, scurrying, I think you use that word, and that's how I would use to scurrying to the zendo in the middle of the night. Really. Very early in the morning. Kind of a romantic notion of, spiritual practice, but it intrigued me, and I liked that. One of the first words that I remember was the phrase, don't waste time.
Don't waste time. Thank you. Anybody else? One more? Yeah.
My memory isn't very good, so straight lines. I can't really pinpoint a line. But for me, coming into the Zen practice, I was drawn by the community.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the community is what got me becoming larger and larger.
Thank you. Beautiful. So thank you for bringing that in, because again, it's not always a word. You know, it could be something that you saw. You saw these people scurrying in the what seemed like the middle of the night, right? For you, you feel the warmth and the presence of other beings and community. So all of these are these they're kind of indescribable. I mean, we can talk about it, we can name it, but the kind of the mystery of it and why is it that it touches us so deeply? We don't have to know why, but it does, and we come, and often we stay because of that. So I would like to share another phrase from a Zen teaching that probably, if I had heard this in the beginning, it wouldn't have been so special to me because it seems kind of esoteric. But, you come and you practice well and your ear kind of gets attuned to some of the symbology and the way of the Zen stories. And so this is one that I'm still currently really, really practicing with, and I just wanted to share it with you and tell you a little bit about how and why I'm resonating with it. Because it seemed, I was thinking, okay, it's almost the solstice. We're in almost in the time of the darkest dark. We're 3 days away from that. You know, I was looking, in fact, I was telling Kokyo the other day, it seems like this is the third year in a row I've done the talk right before the solstice. So it's kind of cool. I'm feeling like, I'm here in my seat. I've talked about the darkness before, and I think I talked about struggling with family and generosity 1 year. Well, this year I was just really, I don't know, it was pretty elemental for me. It was feeling pretty elemental. So this line came to me. But in order to tell you the line, I have to give you a little bit of backstory. I don't know if it'll help or not, but a little context at least. So the setting of this line is there is a famous Zen teacher. He's not directly in our lineage, but very close. And he has several names, but one of them in Japanese, he's called Seppo. And Seppo is one of my favorites because he's the guy, and please indulge me, I get to tell stories because I'm up here. I get to tell the stories I like. Seppo is the guy who was out on pilgrimage with his Dharma brother, and they were, there was a snowstorm, the story goes, and they were staying in a barn or something like that. And Seppo never felt like he was getting it. Those are the ancestors I really like. He always felt like he wasn't making the mark. And so he would sit really hard and try to, like, get better, try to wake up. So there he was, sitting in zazen. His friend was kind of lounging over there. His friend goes, "Yeah, what are you doing? Like, come on, relax, you know? What do you think you're going to get by doing that?" And, you know, Seppo's just, I have to make this effort. And his friend was chiding him a little bit. But then he kind of took pity on him. And so we got him. He said, "Okay, so tell me about your struggle. It looks like you're really kind of struggling and trying to figure out how to be a better student. So tell me about it." So Seppo told him about all his, "I tried this and it didn't work, and I worked with that teacher and it didn't work, and I didn't get this and I didn't get that, and, you know, it's just really hard." And his friend finally says, "Oh, God, don't you get it? Don't you get it? The family treasure doesn't come in through the gate. It flows forth from your own heart." And at that moment, Seppo, that was his turning phrase. "Oh, it doesn't come in from through the gate. It flows from my heart." And he called himself Tortoise Mountain. "Oh," he said, "old Tortoise Mountain has finally realized the way." And he spent the rest of his days teaching and actually became quite famous. So in this story I'm going to tell now, he is the great master in the story who has a monastery at Tortoise Mountain. But he, you know, I love that his turning, his awakening, was his friend saying to him, "Just share your heart, brother. Don't try to understand everybody else's dharma and repeat everybody else's stories. Give us what you've got." And that was his opening. That was his awakening. So in this particular story, which is told in Dogen's fascicle called Dotoku, which is in the Shobogenzo, and I'm only going to tell part of it. I've told this story many times. I'm just going to tell the first part. So in this story, here's Seppo. He's got his monastery, and he's practicing. And he and the monks in the monastery start telling him, there's this guy that lives, or gal, who knows. There's this monk that lives outside of the monastery at the edge of the ravine in a hut. There's a hut master. And this hut master is really, really wise. And they're all, "Shh." Seppo goes, "Oh, really?" And says to his kind of head student person, "Why don't you go check him out? Go check out the hut master." So, boop, 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 "I'm going to go check out the hut master." Off he goes, leaves the monastery, goes around, goes to the edge of the ravine. There's the hut, and there's the hut master. Now, he asks him a question, and this question, "Why did Bodhidharma come from the West?" is kind of code in Zen for, you know, what's the meaning of Zen? Because Bodhidharma brought Zen from India to China, and in China, that was the West. So why did Bodhidharma come from the West? What's this all about? So the snappy head student goes over, finds the hut master, says, "Hey, you, why did Bodhidharma come from the West?" And the hut master said, "The ravine is deep, so the dipper handle is long." That's my line. There's lots of more good lines in that story. I will, that's another time, or you can go back in the archives and check it out. Just going to stay with just this one. Just this one. "The ravine is deep, so the dipper handle is long." Ugh. So when I first resonated with that, I didn't even really know why, because I don't, you know, what does that mean? You know, the mind wants to try to understand these things, but of course, it's the body, and it's the body relaxing and settling and opening away from the little tight mind that's trying to figure everything out, and it's actually opening to perceive the broader field. And I think to me that's one of the first really deep impacts that that statement has on me, is it makes me open up and start perceiving ravine. What's the ravine? What is this? What is a ravine? I mean, just thinking about it like that. I mean, a ravine is a place where a river has flowed for so long and it has worn away the rock for millennia, and the rock wears away, and it gets deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And so this is what often, you know, is what makes a ravine. And this hut master lives at the edge of the ravine, outside of the monastery. I take comfort in that, because I don't live in the monastery, and I never will. I have for short periods of time, 3 months, three different times, beautiful, beautiful, incredible practice, beautiful experience. I highly recommend it, and yet I always would know this is not my home. So this story about one who chooses to live not in the monastery, at the edge of the ravine, in a hut, there's something just very, I just relate to it. I have a hut. Jean built me a hut in the backyard. And there's going to be a time, I don't know when it's going to be, but it's going to happen, where I stay there for a while. And I say, if you want to visit me, you need to come to my hut, because I'm not coming out. I don't know when that's going to be, but it's going to happen sometime. And I've even had ravines that show up in my dreams. There's a particular ravine that I have dreamt about many, many times. I've even flown over this ravine. So, and then last year I saw it in waking life. I saw it. My friend led me to it. He didn't know it was that ravine, but it was a ravine. Let's go, let's look. And I got to this edge of this ravine, and I just, there it is. So I feel like I live on the edge of the ravine. So that's why I like this. And I want to learn how to dip my dipper all the way down into the ravine. To taste, to try to touch, to try to access this what? The water, the cool air, the source wisdom. And then this actually, when I think about this kind of thing, it makes me start thinking of that, actually the line that you brought up, Jean, the, you know, it now is me, I now, I'm not it. Is that the one you said? Yeah, right. And that is from Dongshan's awakening, when he left his teacher and went out into the world. And like so many of the ancestors, like ourselves, was just trying to figure out what it's all about. And he was wading across a stream. He looked down. He saw his reflection. And he awakened when he saw his reflection in the river. And he wrote, Just don't seek from others or you'll be far estranged from self. I now go on alone. Everywhere I meet it. It now is me. I now am not it. One must understand in this way to merge with suchness. And Tighe and Dan Leighton in this book, I highly recommend this book. It's called Just This Is It. And it's all about Dongshan and his teachings. And when he's writing about this experience where Dongshan saw himself in the river and realized, it is me. I now am not it. Sounds like opposites, but this is welcome to Zen, right? It's true. That is, he's a person. He exists. He can see his reflection in the river. But what's that? You know, it's me, but it's not me. It's both me and not me. And so Tighe writes a little bit about that and says, the it of just this is totally inclusive, incorporating everything. So it truly was him, the totality of his being, yet he could not personally claim to encompass it all. This depicts the relationship of the limited I, the egoistic self-clinging, the relationship of that one to the all-encompassing universal nature, of which any individual I is simply a particular partial expression. So there's something about this ravine that to me, This and not just the ravine, but the ravine is deep, so the dipper handle is long. It's this relationship between this one who necessarily has her own ego and her own way of looking at the world and this vast, you know, the 10,000 things, the depth of the ravine, that which is larger than me, that which I cannot comprehend, that which is incomprehensible, inconceivable. We talk about the inconceivable Dharma. Literally inconceivable. You can't conceive it. It is not conceivable. So what is it? It's not nothing, but it's not conceivable. Right? This begins to enter that this is the mystery realm of Zen. You know, this is the part where it's a bit of a leap of faith. I believe it's a bit of a leap of faith because if you try to get too, if your little small mind comes in and starts to get too, but, you're just going to get frustrated. Right? But this beautiful turning of these words and the ways that the teachings turn us and turn the words in us and open us to this inclusion, this participation in this vaster, inconceivable experience that we can have here as humans. I wrote something. Let's see what I wrote. Because of the power and persistence of our small ego mind, we might fancy... Oh, excuse me, but let me first speak to the value of small ego mind. I don't want anybody to get the idea that I'm sitting up here somehow preaching that there's anything wrong with our small ego mind. I love my small ego mind. It's important. Our egos are what help us organize the sensory details of the world. Our egos are what make distinctions. Our egos help us go through the door and not bang into the wall. You know, it's the differentiating function. It's ethics. It's ethics. It's the difference between this and that. No, not anything, not whatever. No, this. Not that. That's a function of ego. Helps us learn. Wow, I didn't know that, you know? It's not just oneness. It's particularity. Okay, so love you, little small ego mind, and it's not all there is. There's also big mind. Maybe you've heard about that in Zen. We talk about small mind and big mind. So because of the power and the persistence of our small ego mind, we might fancy that we are the center of the universe and that the world revolves around our human story. But if you spend any time under the night sky or in a mountain storm or in a meadow filled with spring flowers and buzzing bees, if you're drinking tea one morning and you look out and see the sky ablaze with dawn and you feel you simply must go outside right this second to bear witness to this flashing moment of the earth's turning, then you know through your own direct experience about these forces that are greater than the human small mind. And you sense that there is a whole sovereign universe that exists outside of our conception. It's greater than us, but it also is us, as Dongshan had his experience. I now am not it, but it is me. You know, the trees breathe out and we breathe in. We only live because the trees breathe out and we breathe in. And in the other way, we, you know, our cars and our airplanes spit out toxins and the ocean's warm. Intimate relationship that we have with these forces and these beings, with the water, with the air, with the trees, with other animals. And so I think part of what I'm hoping that humanity learns how to do before it's too late is learn how to make our dipper handles much, much longer so we can reach much deeper and actually feel and taste and touch and hear and be in relationship with these forces and beings that are inconceivable to our particular human realm. That we may taste the source water flowing at the bottom of the ravine. Katagiri says in a piece of, in a commentary that he did about hearing beyond the irritation of our consciousness. There's a translation in the Heart Sutra that talks about the walls of the mind, that our mind, it's like our mind is in walls. And this hear it, being able to hear beyond the irritation of our consciousness. That line actually comes from the Jukai ceremony. I first heard it. This was a turning phrase for me. I first heard it when I went to my first Jukai or lay ordination ceremony. There were a couple people here in the community who first asked Catherine if she would give them the precepts. And, you know, of course, as you know, you hold up your rakusu if you have a rakusu. Yeah, those little rakusus, right. So that's a rakusu. And so if you get to a certain place where you just feel like, you know, I like this Buddhism. This makes sense to me. I want to walk this path. I want to work with a teacher. And you do. And at some point you have a public ceremony where after sewing your rakusu, you get it back with a name and then you wear it as Buddha's robe. So that's the Jukai ceremony. And the first time I heard these words, it was at Catherine's commentary in the Jukai ceremony. I had never heard words like that before. Beyond the irritation of our consciousness? Never, ever in my life had I heard such a thing. But again, it was that, oh, wow, that sounds pretty interesting. So it's coming on time when at some point pretty soon I'm going to stop talking. But I did want to take the opportunity to make that little segue because most of you know, but maybe not all of you do, and I would really like to invite all of you That very ceremony of Jukai will be happening here on Saturday from 2 to 4. It will be the very first time that I give the precepts to a student who asked me 10 years ago on a walk in Pogonit Park when we were talking about the Dharma, and she asked if I would be her teacher. And I said, yeah. And now, Saturday, between 2 and 4, she will be receiving back her rakusu and a new name. So, and I will be reading those very words, as well as other words that Catherine spoke and that Katagiri spoke. It's very, very, very personal. Very, very personal. And it's a little bit kind of like that, you know, that call and response kind of feeling that we have, right, with each other, where you just, I don't know, you hear something, you feel something, and then you're ready to come forward and take your next step. So that might be all that I want to say. Let me just look and see if there's anything else here. Yeah, I think that's all that I would like to say right now. And so, I would love to know what phrase, word, teaching, concept are you grappling with, chewing on now? If there is one. What is it that puzzles you or that intrigues you in the Dharma, in your connection with the Dharma, in your practice, in your life? Yeah.
Well, this very minute.
This very minute.
I'm intrigued by the zipper handle.
Ah.
And I'm wondering if you really meant this with what you said, that we make our zipper handles longer, because for me, I don't think I have that kind of ability to make it longer. I think what it is as long as it needs to be, I need to tap into the awareness of the length of the handle. So it's coming.
Sounds like a good practice. How long is my dipper handle? What's it dipping into? Maybe it's not so long. What is it? What's it touching?
You could
contemplate that. Well, that's certainly possible, and I'm not going to disagree with you. And I would also say that I think sometimes when we just keep practicing, it surprises us sometimes. Maybe years later, you think your dipper handle is a certain length, but you realize that you're able to access something that surprises you. So I think that the encouragement I would give you is don't be too sure that you know how long it's supposed to be, and it's enough, it's not enough. It's almost like just keep practicing. Just keep practicing. Just keep practicing. And then maybe periodically you check it out. Yeah, what are you working with? What are you chewing on?
Probably things more than this, but this occurred to me just in our talk. It isn't disturbing me. But it's the thought that, first of all, I would really love to sit with Seppo, or no,
with the hut master. Okay.
And whatever he said would be wonderful.
Good, go do that. Make sure you do that. Soon.
Yeah. And then I thought to myself, well, what if that metaphor in my own mind, I had one that I was more comfortable with, that was similar.
Yeah. There you go. That would be your response.
Right. No disrespect to my wonderful friend who would love to sit with.
We're all different. We all have a different response to the question, why did Bodhidharma come from the West?
No, and just to, you know, just because of my sense that I think is common among us that going down to the river, and especially stepping into the river, is a really deep and strong need for all of us. That's why that kind of stuff. So.
Well, I went down to the river to pray. Studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the road and crown? Good Lord, show me the way. Well, I think it's time for us to close for now. And I think there's some tea outside. I think it stopped raining, so we can go and sniff the beautiful leafy darkness. Drink some tea, and please come on Saturday at 2 o'clock and join the Bodhisattva, a baby Bodhisattva being born in the world. All right. May we all take whatever... medicine we've drunk from the dipper tonight out into the darkness and do what we can to help awaken together with all beings. Beings are numberless. I
I vow to be kindness.